Welcome to another edition of Radioactive Magazine with this week's host, Dave Mitchell. Today, we will be exploring the dynamics of our increasingly polarized politics with John Shively, who is instructor of political sciences and history at the Metropolitan Community College's Longview campus. John, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, glad you're here. Let's start off with the first question, which I'm sure will spark quite a bit of conversation. Less than 1 week after calling for party unity in his State of the Union speech, President Trump used the word treason at a speech near Cincinnati to describe Democrats' lack of response to much of his State of the Union speech. At his speech in Cincinnati, he initially called the Democrats un-American, and then he pointed to someone in the audience stating, I quote, "Somebody said treasonous. I mean, yeah, I guess. Why not? Can we call that treason? Why not? I mean, they certainly don't love our country very much." And I obtained that from the Business Insider on February 5th, 2018. President Trump obviously set the stage by using the word un-American and then giving voice to the word treason used by an audience member. He would not have engaged in this dynamic unless he felt confident of being positively received. It is a profound tragedy that our political polarization has degenerated to the point where there is an emotional base for such a loaded and negative term to be applied to Democratic behavior at the State of the Union, a term which has no application in that context, only a demonization of the other side. Murray Stein is a Jungian psychoanalyst, and he was interviewed in 2012 by Pythia Pei for her book, America on the Couch. In discussing the 2012 presidential election, he stated, quote, "Out of the dialectic between two polarities, a new possibility emerges. But if the opposites, or in this case the two parties, become completely unrelated, then the collective psyche is in danger of splitting. There's no forward movement. There's just mutual aggression, stalemate, and stagnation. The system doesn't evolve, it devolves, and you don't want to see that happen." And then Pythia Pei interviewed another psychologist, Harriet Lerner, for the same book, and she made comments about the chronic effects of chronic anxiety on human systems. Common traits identified were rigidified thinking, a loss of objectivity, steep decline in civility, cooperation, and empathy, lack of orientation to the facts, inability to tolerate complexity, a pushing of people to the extremes. From your perspective as someone who teaches political science and history, what are your observations on the increasing political polarization in our society, Trump's comments in the context of this polarization, and the comments by the psychologist Murray Stein and Harriet Lerner?
Well, first, as a historian, I would argue that we've gone through periods of polarization in our history before. Clearly, the most obvious one was the Civil War. North and South could not agree that the South's economic system, political system, was compatible with the ideal of American values. The country splits up, we fight a war, we rejoin, and we move forward. We've gone through periods such as that, usually not to that extreme. Now, what I would argue about today is Donald Trump isn't the cause of this. A lot of people want to place him as being the cause of this. He's not the cause. He's a product of the polarity that's happening right now. He is making it worse with comments such as treasonous. Typically, we don't refer to the opposition party as being treasonous.
When they're not clapping at a State of the Union.
Right. And I think that part of that is there is a personal component to this, and that's where I think, you know, the problem with Trump is our example. I mean, he is what he is, but there's a personal component to that that has not existed among virtually any of our presidents historically regarding how they view the world looking at them. You know, Trump obviously feels that everyone should respect him and applaud what he has to say. But we have recently, when Barack Obama was president, a congressman yelled out, liar, when Obama was giving his State of the Union address. So there's even recent example where people disagree with the speaker. They're usually not so vocal. The point of a society in free speech and where we have opposing ideas and the ideas that we kind of work those together and come up with a solution that a consensus can agree to is that you must listen to everybody else. And I find that part of the problem in today's polarization is people have stopped listening to each other. People have stopped hearing what the other person is saying or the other side is saying. And to mention your psychologist, the idea that we're getting to a point where we're losing that center, if you will, that common sense of who we are and what we believe in, is definitely problematic, especially how do you fix all of this? Because at some point, there are going to be large issues that we're going to have to resolve and have to do so, hopefully absent a war, a nuclear attack on North Korea or vice versa, or an economic downturn rivaling the Great Depression. Absent those, we still have a lot of problems to solve. Regardless of whether you believe that we have a changing climate, there are issues involved with climate change that have to be dealt with. I'm not sure that it matters whether man's causing it or not. If you recognize that there are problems, we have to make changes. A new study has shown that American military bases and naval bases are at risk due to climate change. Just one example. Economic policy. The United States, we just passed a huge tax cut. So we are at the lowest point of revenue to GDP we will be at in a year or two that rivals only the period of the Great Depression. We're not going to be having money coming in. We're racking up deficits because you're not getting the associated budget cuts to go along with those, nor will you in this environment. What are we going to do at some point when all the bills come due and there's no money to pay for it?
The one comment that struck me that I think is quite true is that the polarization existed before Trump came on the scene. And I think a mistake of the left is that they think that if they get rid of Donald Trump, that everything's going to be all right. He's definitely fanning the flames, I think. No question about that. What's your comment about the left and their attitude towards that situation?
Well, I agree with you.
Assuming that my assessment is correct about the left.
Actually, I agree with you that Donald Trump is a problem unlike we've had before. Mm-hmm. Partly because when you've elected a conservative, for example, you always knew what that conservative stood for. They had sort of a base set of principles mm-hmm. that the other side, okay, we may disagree with you, but we know that's where you stand. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure you can ever really figure out where Donald Trump stands on anything at any particular time. It makes discourse very difficult. Uh-huh. Now, perhaps he's doing this on purpose because he likes to keep the opposition sort of off stride, or perhaps he really doesn't have anything solid in terms of what he wants to accomplish as president other than being successful and making America great again, which, of course, he's not even defined what that means. But I do think that liberals are kind of at a loss to try to figure out where exactly they can sit down and come to terms with Donald Trump. And the recent discussion and arguments over immigration reform demonstrate the difficulty of trying to figure out what Trump wants and what he doesn't want. Because he will say at a cabinet meeting, they staged a cabinet meeting where there was a back and forth, and then he said a few things that looked promising, and then, you know, the next day, they're walking back all those statements. It's really tough to sit down and come to an agreement with somebody if you don't trust that the other side's going to keep up their agreement. Now, I promise you, I'm sure that conservatives would say the same thing about liberals. And so I'm not just attacking conservatives here. But this is a problem in our politics today. We can't even agree on the problems, let alone the solutions. And if you can't agree what the problem is, then you can't figure out, well, how to best to resolve that problem or to at least deal with it or kick it down the road. And what they've been doing is now they've been kicking everything down the road for a long time. But I think that's where Trump is a particular problem. I mean, Ronald Reagan was Mr. Conservative at the time when he was elected. And yet he was very clear about his principles and what his bottom lines were on virtually everything. And Democrats actually were able to work with him because they understood where his sort of wiggle room and his area of compromise was. George H.W. Bush decided to do a – turned out to be a career killer for him. But he raised taxes at a time that revenues were necessary. I don't know that you can get any kind of, recognizable set of bottom line principles from our current president.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
it really makes right. politics hard.
Right.
And I don't think even his own party really knows mm-hmm. where he stands on things. And they're right. left guessing.
Uh-huh.
Because you had a party that was all about getting rid of Obamacare. And yet when they were trying to sit down and fashion a bill that would do it, Donald Trump was sending conflicting signals even to his right. own party members, and right. they were doing what he wanted.
Yeah. Well, let's I did craft a question on the Affordable Care Act, and let's get to that question if I can find it here. Yeah, here it is. The polarization surrounding the Affordable Care Act, while it was being debated before it was passed, paranoia ran rampant. Insane ideas were circulated. Death panels were going to kill elderly people. Our medical system was going to be socialized and taken over by the federal government. Despite about a year-long hearings process in Congress, the entire Republican Party voted against the ACA, with it narrowly passing a Democratic Congress. During President Obama's tenure, the Republicans demonized the ACA mercilessly, vowing to repeal it. Yet, in 2017, with the advent of the Trump administration, as well as Republican control of Congress, it became obvious they had no ideas which came close to the social benefit provided by the ACA. Their proposals for repeal and replace, as evaluated by the Congressional Budget Office, led to estimates of as many as 23 million people losing their health insurance. The Republicans failed to repeal the ACA, which amazingly enough began to be more popular after the 2016 election in the face of widespread public outcry. Republicans put a great deal of energy into the demonizing process aimed at the ACA, a process not based in reality, with very little apparent effort made to develop any meaningful alternative. The Trump administration did succeed in getting rid of the individual mandate to buy insurance, a fundamental pillar of the ACA, as a relatively unnoticed amendment to the recently passed tax cut bill. President Trump then declared victory, claiming the ACA was now repealed. What is your assessment of how our polarization process affects the years-long debate and the social costs suffered as a consequence? And mainly, you know, I think, you know, there was a years-long demonization process on the part of Republicans towards the ACA. And, you know, if collectively you put that much energy into demonizing something and practically no energy into developing reasonable policy alternatives, or on the other hand, proposing your policy alternatives that modify the ACA significantly, there's no constructive process. It's just all demonization and all the time, and then you get to the reality of things when you get in power and you have no ideas. So it's just sort of there and. You know, with their inability to repeal the ACA, you know, they go to attaching it as an amendment to the tax cut bill that was relatively unnoticed, and just to get their way, you know, so because they put their pride behind the demonization process. So it's like process is extremely destructive. What are your reactions to all these?
Well, no, actually, I think that's a pretty good microcosm of our politics now. Couple of things, though, to start off with. First, when Social Security was passed in the 1930s and when Medicare was passed in the 1960s, those two bills received very little Republican support. Democratic presidents were in power Great Depression, Great Society, and they received very little Republican support. And sometimes when you do a pretty significant piece of legislation that's essentially a society changer for this country, it will lock people into who support that into supporting that party for a long time. Just as African Americans supported the Republican Party from the end of the Civil War until the 1930s because the Republican Party ended slavery. So Republicans were reluctant to give Democrats the Affordable Care Act. And ironically, the bill that was actually passed was developed by the Heritage Foundation, a conservative think tank. It was implemented by Mitt Romney in Massachusetts. Granted, Massachusetts is a liberal state, but Romney was, in fact, a Republican governor at the time. It had been fairly successful. Giving people something that they can sort of bank on gets people into supporting it and realizing that it is a necessary part of their life. The demonization that you're talking about was trying to prevent the Affordable Care Act from ever actually going into effect. So there was a really strong effort to try to get people not to sign up and participate, telling people that these are all the bad things that are going to happen. Do you want Uncle Sam picking your doctor? To which I would respond, well, my employer picks my doctors now, and between my employer and Uncle Sam, I kind of think Uncle Sam probably has a little bit more out for me than interest in me and my well-being than perhaps my employer might, because their job is profits, or I teach college, so I don't know about profits, but cutting costs, okay? So with all of that going ahead of time, then the Affordable Care Act kicks in, number of signups is actually pretty significant. The cost of the rise in healthcare slows a bit, and people are starting to feel, okay, maybe it's not so bad, but I'm still not sure. There's problems with it. The Democrats passed the bill knowing exactly what problems existed that still needed to be worked out. Their hope was that you could go back and work those out, which would have given the Republicans a chance to alter that piece of legislation in ways that they would be more comfortable with. But it would still be seen as Obamacare and a Democrat bill. So then when the specter came that everyone was going to now lose something that now they had started to take for granted, they got upset. They organized, they made phone calls, they visited congressmen and senators' offices. They really made it clear that they did not want this taken away. Now, the interesting thing about it is, okay, when an overwhelming majority of people say, we want to keep this, why is it then that now you have to get rid of it? Sure, there's things that need to be fixed, but it did do some basic things that the Republicans, when they were trying to fashion a bill, which, look, they had how long? 7 years?
Seven years to come up with a
new bill, and they didn't do anything. You know, there's some basic things we agree on. Everyone should have access to health care at reasonable rates. We can have a range of policies as long as we have something that gives us a couple of doctor visits and maybe help us with prescriptions. We want the ability that males and females do not pay decidedly different amounts for health insurance, that kids could stay on their parents' policies until they were 26, which helps.
Yeah, that was very popular.
And I think those are things where you could start to fashion something else. The real question is, when the Affordable Care Act was negotiated, certain groups made out better than others. Drug companies made out really well. They were able to get the things that they wanted. Certain other large medical groups were not able to get some of the things they wanted. And so since a bill was crafted that didn't cover what everybody's wish list was, then you start to sow the seeds for disenchantment. And I hate to say this, but I think one of Donald Trump, if he does have a guiding principle as president, is I wanted to undo everything my predecessor did or do everything that he didn't do. And this was one of those things. And I guess where I have an issue is that, you know, you're talking about polarization. My question is there more polarization in Congress than there is actually out among the masses? Because in some cases, I would say, they're kind of the same, and one reflects the other. But in others, I think there's a much larger set of agreement than we want to admit.
Well, so. I know in a prior conversation with you in preparing for the show that you said that the middle, the political middle in this country is not as strong or as solid as it used to be. And that there is now more social room, political room for the extremes to assert themselves. And can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. I think that, and the question you asked is an important one to try to understand what's happening today, because we could go around all day and blame one part or the other for what's happening. But when one party starts to move into a polar opposite direction of the other one, the other party's reaction is going to be to do the same. And so when both sides are escaping from the middle and moving more towards the ends, you're getting to a point where you have like ideological purity. And once that happens, you don't have enough people that support your policies. And the big middle is left kind of with nothing. And so either those folks have to be drug along to the ends to try to get something, or they lose the ability to find someone to hear their voices and to pursue their interests in our political system. And the other issue is, I tell students, you know, the people in the ends are also the loudest voices. They will scream to be heard. Richard Nixon referred to the silent majority, which I think is really a pretty good description. Not the way he used it, but the idea that there is a great middle, that most of us, we just do our lives. We have certain things we want to make sure government does and doesn't do. And we go on about our business. And when something gets messed up, we would like it fixed. But we're not going to go scream from the rooftops and demonize the other side and say, well, you haven't fixed this. You deserve to go to the gallows or something. We're not going to call people treasonous if they disagree with us. But when you get to the ends, that's when the hyperbole starts. That's when the unacceptance of the other side starts, because at that point you are so far apart, you can't even begin to understand the other side's views, let alone being able to sit down and say, okay, how do we work with those?
Yeah, you know, John, the thing, though, is that as each side becomes more polarized, tribalism kicks in and people start to adhere to their party no matter what. And I guess for the Republican Party, it's sort of like moderate Republicans get sort of frozen out, you know, and they sort of disappear politically. And, you know, I think that's a real problem. I mean, it just as both parties become more polarized, the people that say they're Democrat or Republican start to become more polarized as well. And as an example, I would say that in 2008, the Republican Party was somewhat reasonable about global warming and the need to reduce carbon emissions and all that. There was agreement to a certain extent. But in 2016, the Republican Party was diametrically opposed to the idea of global warming and the fact that you had to reduce emissions from the Democratic Party. And so it's become a very it's a process that kind of feeds on itself.
I think when you mentioned tribalism and this idea of pulling apart, you know, the psychological aspects of what we're talking about, I think, are often underplayed in the media and in the press, because I think they play a much larger role than is given credit. When someone attacks your views or tries to point out that you're factually wrong about something, rather than saying, oh, hey, maybe you're right, let's talk about that, the reaction is you tend to sort of double down on your own position. You tend to think that the other side is attacking you personally, and you're going to respond in a defensive manner. And when both sides respond defensively to things, again, that is just one other thing that sort of force that pushes you apart rather than sitting down. I mean, right before here we were talking, we can't even agree on basic facts anymore. Real problem when you're trying to solve problems and have discourse. If you can't agree on facts, forget the opinion part. We can't even agree on the facts.
Yeah, you were even talking about how certain personalities on the right were claiming that the shooting in Florida didn't even happen. And so if you get to that point where you're denying reality, then you have a real problem. And of course, I'd be very surprised if there are very many people that actually subscribe to that viewpoint. But the fact that you have the more radical types out there making that statement is scary. It's scary.
Well, I think, you know, one of the things to sort of begin to resolve this, and I hate putting pressure or a necessity to look at the media, but before we had cable and this wide choices of different channels and different places to get your news and information, let alone social media, you had three basic networks that figured out this is the consensus of the things we should all be talking about as a society. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of power. Maybe we disagree that the media should have that much power, but they served a real purpose. Now, there's so much media and it is so fragmented that they're not even helping us bring us together. You mentioned certain personalities were arguing things that didn't happen. You have a lot of people who have talk shows and radio shows on both sides who are in all sorts of conspiracy theories about things, and they get followers, and those people become a problem because they're not listening to facts. They're not open to information. And, you know, the only way you're going to reverse this, A, I think we have to do a better job of educating our young people about our system and what it is supposed to be and how it should function for the benefit of not a narrow group of people, but for all of us.
What about breaking up media conglomerates? What about that?
I think that would be a really great idea in one
sense. So the Rupert Murdoch doesn't have control of 40% of the media market is
right,
or whatever the percent. I'm not sure the percent, but he's
it's huge, he's, and you
it's
have
a lot.
You have radio station owners like Clear Channel or iHeartRadio. You now have McClatchy newspapers and all these, and they're sort of merging. And what it is, media has become such a big business now. I mean, it's always been a business. It's always been about profits, but it's different now. And ratings are even more crucial. And so the headlines have to get more exaggerated and
more extreme.
And that's what's reported. And the media has to create interest, they have to promote every story as having two sides. Not every story has two sides. Most, granted, but not every story. But now you're propping up one side that really shouldn't be given equal weight, and you're given equal weight. And people, unsophisticated listeners, and even some sophisticated listeners, will see that and realize, wait a minute, so there is something there. Mm-hmm. It's just a logical conclusion.
Right. Well, you know, I think the other thing is what I was mentioning before our talk today, that I really do think that people need to recognize how they themselves engage in demonizing processes and projection to the other side, and that there has to be personal recognition that you are doing it yourself, and take responsibility for that. I think that definitely needs to happen.
Well, and to your point, and I think it's something that you've alluded to, one of the things about social media is you can demonize whoever, but it depersonalizes it. You just go on your computer or your phone and you type in a little tweet or a message and you send it out there.
And it's completely anonymous.
Right, and you're not confronting. Well, and you have a fake persona and you're not confronting anybody. Mm-hmm. And that's what happens. It used to be in the old days when I was a kid, if you're bullied, it's because someone's doing it to you on the playground. They're not sending you an anonymous note on Facebook that makes you want to go commit suicide.
Right.
What I'm saying here is, and it's important, is that it has become way too easy to attack people as a means to distract and to prevent things from happening, rather than it used to be, how do we make things happen? What, as a country, you know, I said earlier, I think we've lost our consensus about who we are as a people and where we should be going. What has this country done in a big sense since, frankly, the 1960s? You know, going to the moon, that was a big deal. What have we rallied around since then as a country or as a people that this is what we should be doing? If we're the leaders of the free world and if we're going to be in a leadership position because of our economic capacity and our military capacity, we ought to be leading towards something. And I think that if you want to sort of break some of this, we can find something that everyone can buy into and say, hey, wait a minute. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's something that we should be doing as a country.
Okay.
Make America great again. I'm all about the slogan, just not the way it's been used.
Yeah, John, I couldn't agree with you more. It makes all sorts of sense to me that our country is drifting in a lot of ways and that there really is a lack of vision on both sides. But unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. We've run out of time. We could have very easily talked for at least an hour on this thing, on this whole entire issue. But thank you very much for being on the show, and hopefully we can talk again.
Thank you for having me. I'd love to.